So the Internet of Everything is a new term that's starting to replace the term Internet of Things. So if things are going to be connected to the Internet, and everything is connected to the Internet, then it's really, isn't it the Internet of Everything? And I'm Mike Sheamus from the School of Computer Science at Carnegie Mellon University. I also have an appointment at the University of Hong Kong, and had so since 2001. And this logo over here, ISR, the Institute for Software Research, that's the department that I'm in at Carnegie Mellon University. Some people in it actually do software research. I don't do any software research. My background, for those who don't know me, is I started out as a computer scientist a long time ago, got a PhD from Yale, then went immediately to teach at Carnegie Mellon University. The first September that I was there, that I wasn't in school, I decided it was time to go back to school. So I went and got a law degree from Duquesne University, which is in Pittsburgh. So I was a professor during the day, and then I was a lowly student at night. And I went through that transformation four times a week for 3 years. And so I'm sensitive to two things. I'm sensitive to the torture that professors impose on students, and I'm also sensitive to people who go to school at night, because I do. And so when I teach here at HKU, most of the students that I have are night students. They're not full-time students. I've been on the faculty since 1975. If you do some arithmetic here, you'll see that I actually started before I got my PhD. I was in my first academic appointment, and what they very politely informed me was that I would not have a second academic appointment unless I actually got the PhD. So I actually had to write my thesis while I was a faculty member at CMU. I'm in two departments. That's not a lot, actually, at CMU. There are many people who are in more. It's extremely easy to have cross appointments at CMU because we really don't have barriers either between departments or even between different schools of the university. There are many, many collaborative programs. Right now, my main job is as director of the master's program in e-business technology, which is a parallel program to the ICOM program here at HKU. And they were started right around the same time. Okay, so we're going to talk about the Internet of Everything, and there are lots of things in this room. So, for example, here's a chair. And the question I ask you is, would it make sense to give this chair an IP address, an Internet Protocol address, so it could communicate with other people and with other things? Or is just that a stupid, geeky idea that would excite electrical engineers and computer scientists, but would have no relevance to the world at large? So I've posed that question many times, and lots of ideas have come forth from audiences. One thing that you could do, of course, is if you could put a sensor in the seat, and you could determine whether anybody was sitting there. Well, that's nice. What are the uses of that? Well, you could also use it to take attendance. Since everybody has a cell phone, and everybody's cell phone emits information that identifies them, then I could have another sensor in the seat that told not only was it occupied, but who was actually occupying. And students play the game of permuting themselves. They sit in different seats all the time, so the professor can't recognize who's there and who's not there. But if everything were instrumented, then I would be able to know that. Okay, well, taking attendance is not really that much of a burden. I don't think we have to buy a lot of electronics to save professors the chore of taking attendance, which is often done by their TA anyway. TA has to do something to earn his stipend. But let's look at this. Maybe you don't know, but a human being emits as much energy as a 100-watt light bulb. So if there are 70 people in the room, that's the equivalent of 7,000 watts of light. The fluorescent lights in this room, I'm guessing a total of maybe 1,500 watts. So 7,000 watts heats up a room. As you know, when you're in a room that's crowded with people, then it gets warm. And so this imposes a load on the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system of the building. So if we knew how many seats were occupied and in which rooms, we would be able to distribute the load properly based on who was in these rooms without having to go and fiddle with thermostats. So once you start thinking about giving an object an IP address and some sensors and allowing it to be interrogated and allowing other things to allowing it to interrogate other things, now all of a sudden you can think of lots and lots and lots of applications for the Internet of Everything. So I have some objects up here. Here's an automobile. We'll talk a lot about automobiles later, because the automobile to me is the perfect IT platform. The reason is that they're very heavy, and if you add even a few hundred pounds of computer to a car, it doesn't hurt the car. Whereas you can't add a few hundred pounds of computer to a person. They won't carry it around with them. Even if they were capable, they won't do it. Another thing is there's no shortage of power in a car, because it has not only a battery, but it has a generator. So when the engine is running, it generates as much power as you could possibly need for computation. Also, cars need information. They need information about where they are, or the GPS system. They need information about road conditions. They need to know if there's construction or if there are delays up ahead. So it's a terrific IT platform. So you can easily see why you would want that thing to be on the Internet. Watch, I don't have to say anything because the iWatch is about to come out. I heard the initial price is $2,990 US or something for it. Very expensive.
The gold version.
The gold version. That's the one that Paul has been on. Now, this thing you might recognize is a gas meter. Yes, it's for natural gas in a house or in the industrial facility. Now, why would you want to give a gas meter an IP address? You can say so.
Because you don't want the guy going up to your house.
So it used to be an incredible pain that every once in a while, when you didn't know or didn't expect it, the doorbell would ring, you were dripping wet from the shower, and it was the guy from the gas company who had to come into your house, sometimes go to a place far away from your front door, read the meter for 10 seconds, and then go away. And it's annoying to people who have meters, and it's very expensive for the gas company because the total number of meters the guy can read in a day is very limited. So what we do is we give the gas meter an IP address so it can be interrogated remotely by a server from the gas company. But there's more than that, because there's a flow meter in here. And what the flow meter normally is never read by the gas company, ever. Why? Because it's only when the meter reader is there and he reads the total, he doesn't read the rate at which gas is flowing. Now all of a sudden we'll have perfect information about the utilization of gas in every facility in the gas company's purview. We'll know at what times of day, in which particular houses, gas is used. So now we can do a lot about estimating loads on various parts of the system. Now, it starts to make sense to do this if the electronics is incredibly cheap. If the electronics cost vastly less than the meter itself, then it makes sense to do it. If the electronics cost 10 times as much as the meter, you would never do it. So we're depending on increased internet bandwidth, or increased or decreased cost of attaching internet connections to various devices. We're talking about very low-cost servers. Cost of servers are going down and down and down. Then it becomes economically feasible to do this. What's this? This looks like a greenhouse to me. And why would you give parts of a greenhouse an IP address? Well, if I inserted in the soil moisture sensors that could tell how moist the soil was at a particular time, then you can do microgardening, which means different crops that are growing in the greenhouse need different amounts of moisture to thrive. And so for each different crop, I can measure the moisture in the soil and decide that it's time to turn on the irrigation system to make the thing wetter. Okay, now things get interesting. You recognize this as a doctor's stethoscope. It's a very old instrument. It's over 300 years old. It hasn't been improved in 300 years. It was invented shortly after the circulation of the blood was discovered by Harvey. And it's a silly thing. You know, all it is a tube, and there's a little diaphragm there. And the main constraint of the stethoscope is that it can only be heard by one person at a time, namely the person in whose ears these little things go. And so when a doctor, let's say the resident, is in a hospital and he's bringing the interns along with him and he's examining a patient, what happens? He asks each intern one by one to come up and listen to the patient. Also, there's no record made of what the sounds are. So what happens is, it's a one-shot thing. Whereas, if I gave this thing an IP address and a wireless connection, then when the resident was applying this to a patient, all of the other interns would be able to hear it in their earpiece. Furthermore, if somebody detected an anomaly, he wasn't an expert in hearts, and he knows that something's wrong, but he doesn't know what it is, he could push a button, and experts anywhere in the world could listen in with him to the live heart sound. Furthermore, you could record the heart sound as a wave file and stick them in the patient's medical record. So when they come back next month, you can compare what their heart sounded like a month ago with what it sounds like now. They can't do this now. I mean, the technology exists. They just don't use it. Trucks. Well, trucks are like cars, except they have a lot more power. People who run fleets of trucks like to know where the trucks are. They like to know if the driver is on the authorized route. They like to know how far away he is in time from his destination so they can inform the recipient of the goods to get ready to receive the goods at the warehouse. Okay. This is a Fitbit-like thing, very popular now. You wear this wristband that measures how careful you are with your body and have you exercised long enough today, etc. You can understand I have no interest in this whatsoever. I'm not involved in it, but it's very popular. This is not a very good photo, but it's a razor, ordinary blade razor. And what you may not know is that all Gillette razors, and I'm talking about the blade part, not the handle, the blade part. All Gillette razors, they don't have IP addresses, but they do have radio frequency ID devices in them. And when Gillette buys RFIDs, and we'll talk about that technology a little later, they buy them in quantity half a billion. Buy them 500 million at a time. The reason for that is you don't recover them. When you throw away the blades, you also throw away the RFID device. So they're not recycled. They have to keep buying new ones. This is a jet engine. Why would you want to give a jet engine an IP address? Even aside from the obvious reason, which is you like to know if there's anything wrong with it, or if you can detect conditions that suggest that the thing may fail. And so the next time it lands, they can do some preventive maintenance on it. I think that's a sort of an obvious application. But another application is a new form of doing business, which is instead of selling jet engines, you sell the time for which they work. That is, you don't ask the airline manufacturer to buy the engine, but you say, we're going to charge you just so much money for every hour that the engine is in use. And so if you give it an IP address, then you can measure the amount of time that is in use. It then becomes the burden of the engine manufacturer to make sure the thing keeps working. Because if it's out of service, they're not earning any money from it. And so instrumenting this thing with lots and lots of sensors and connecting to them in real time to detect things that might be going wrong with the engine would be an incredibly valuable thing. Okay. So the original internet, the internet that humans are familiar with, the World Wide Web, really, is an internet of humans. It's an internet of people. Tim Berners-Lee's vision in the early 90s was that you would sit at a keyboard and a web browser, and you would type things, and you would click on hyperlinks, and you would move around the web. And companies communicate with people by having websites. And you would move around on the company website, and you would personally click on stuff and stick it in your shopping cart and buy things. That was the vision. There was not originally a vision of the internet connecting people to things, but yet that's what part of the Internet of Everything is. It's people with things, too. So we can imagine, and here's a person. And the person has various kinds of sensors. So there's a motion sensor on the arm. There are motion sensors on the legs. There's an electrocardiogram sensor, which is actually measuring, not only measuring your heart rate, but actually giving information about what the individual heart valves are doing. And so if this person is wirelessly connected, now how do people become wirelessly connected? It's easy. What I can do is give these devices, these sensors, Bluetooth interfaces. Everybody's cell phone has Bluetooth. and everybody's cell phone is connectable to the internet or to a wireless LAN. And so while you're running, not only is your Fitbit recording, you know, how far you've run, but your electrocardiogram can be uploaded to a server and potential danger can be detected in case you're overstressing your heart. Also, it's a good stress test, so your physician can tell how your heart actually performs under a very carefully measured regime of physical activity. Okay? So this goes a short distance to your phone, which is in your pocket. This goes over the internet to the hospital, medical records, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, if you want to impress your friends with how rigorous your physical activity is, you can upload it to your Facebook page. That's what this is. Okay? Now, I think this seems routine now. Okay. Now we're talking about things connected to things. This is a slide from a French source, which explains the odd language there. But here's a thing, a car. And here's another thing, which is another car, but it's the police car. And if this car is speeding, then that information can be provided to the police, along with the GPS coordinates of this car, so the police can go and arrest the guy, even though they didn't actually see him or measure him speeding, because the server measured him speeding. Now, I know that might not be a very popular use, but consider the following. There are all kinds of devices in the car that are measuring things like how much gas is left. When you're running out of gas, you'd like to know where the nearest gas station is. And so these gas stations can be instrumented to tell how much gas they've got left and what the price of the gas is. And so your car can make a determination of what is the cheapest gas that I can get to with the amount of gas I have remaining in me, for example. Okay? Now this is intended to represent a repair shop. There's some tools there. And so in case something starts to go wrong with the car, but it still runs, you want to be able to get yourself to a repair shop that has the capability of repairing the problem that you have. So if the carburetor needs to be rebuilt, not every garage does that. But they can have an XML page on their server that tells all of the services that they're ready to perform. And are they open now? And do they have capacity to handle you, et cetera? And so that's an example of things connected to things. Now, when we add them together, we take the Internet of Things and the Internet of People, we come up with this. These green things are people, and these orange things are things. And people are talking to people, and they have identities. And things are talking to things. So you know a concept in Facebook is friend of a friend. So if these people are friends, those people are friends, then this is a friend of a friend. So there's a distinct connection between them. The new phrase, get used to it, is friend of a thing, F-O-A-T. An F-O-A-T is a thing that you can interrogate by asking a friend of yours to do it, because the friend is authorized to ask the other thing things. So here, this guy is a friend of that, this guy's a friend of that, so this guy is a friend of a friend of his. Very important idea, because these guys might not necessarily be authorized to talk to one another directly. Now, this has some frightening implications to some people, and I think I can make this clear with some cartoons. What this says, I think my Nest smoke alarm is going off. Google AdWords just pitched me a fire extinguisher and an offer for temporary housing. Now, it's frightening, but of course helpful. Because if you were at the office, wouldn't you like to know that your house was on fire and that arrangements were being made for you to be housed, housed temporarily? Sometimes there's tremendous wisdom in cartoons. Here's another one. You might institute this in my house. Bad news. The scale is threatening to cut off our access to the fridge. So if the scale has an IP address, and the scale has access to the medical records of people, and the people themselves, you can tell that she's on it by her weight. Okay, she probably doesn't have her cell phone with her in the shower. But when she gets on the scale, how does it know that it's her as opposed to him? Well, they have different weights, and if they have the same weight, then it doesn't matter. Okay. So how can you cut off access to the fridge? Well, the fridge is going to be with an internet address also. And the fridge has various devices, including the door to the fridge, which could be remotely lockable. Which you might want to do, by the way, when you're outside the house, when you're out of your house, and various employees like the gardener, et cetera, come in to do things, you might want to lock the fridge so they don't take your food. And here we can have the software in the house actually lock the food for a period of time so that these people who are overweight cannot actually get at their fridge until the fridge decides that it's time to let them in. Okay? Now, some people might benefit from that. Which gets us to the smart home. Now, the smart home can be made very smart because the home has essentially unlimited electrical power. You can put as many computers as you want in a house. And furthermore, it's extremely easy to network things in a house. My house actually is made of concrete and steel, and so it's extremely difficult to have a wireless internet in my house, at least an RF wireless internet. On the other hand, by using power line internet, so these blue lines are the AC power in the house. The AC lines are wonderful. I now have 500 megabit internet all through the house because my fast DSL line comes in here, and everything is distributed all the way through the house. Now, what you can have, of course, is a server in your house that's monitoring everything that's going on in the house and has apps that do various things. Like, for example, if it knows that you're coming home at a particular time, it can set the house to the correct temperature before you get there. When you leave the house, even if you forget to turn down the thermostat or turn it up, depending on cold climate or hot climate, the house knows that you're gone because your cell phone isn't on anymore in the house. It knows that you're not here. And so it will readjust the house automatically even if you don't ask. However, it's not just that. It's all this information can be provided to remote sources that have a need to know it. For example, the power company. The power company would like to know how your thermostats are set because if they know what the weather is going to be this afternoon, and they know the desired temperature in your house, and they've done an energy audit of your house, which they have to do once, to determine how much energy does it take to raise the temperature of the house 1 degree. They know that. Then, by interrogating all the houses in the power network, they can tell how much energy is going to be required to heat or cool houses for the coming afternoon. Why is that good? Why does the power company care about that? Because electric power has the undesirable property that it cannot be stored. DC can sort of be stored in a battery, but you can't store AC. And so if the power company needs more power, it has two choices only. It can generate more, if it has the generating capacity, or it can buy it from somebody else who has the capacity to sell. Well, if you know in advance that you're going to need some power, you can get your order in first to the other power company, buy it before those other dumb power companies figure out that they don't have enough power. What you can see is by starting at the ground up with these individual little devices, going to units the size of a home or the size of an office building or the size of a business, now by aggregating all this information, we can make life much more efficient. Okay, that's the idea. Now, it's a prediction that home automation, that is the selling of various devices like this, internet or network-connected devices in the house, is expected to grow to $50 billion U.S. by 2018. That's a significant market. That's not something anybody wants to do at the moment. Okay, let's move on to smart manufacturing. Manufacturing involves tools and equipment, but also involves people. The concept of smart manufacturing is that you have a factory, and the factory has all kinds of devices in it. There's a shop floor, there are various machines. We can tell whether a drill press is busy or not if we instrument it, we give it an IP address. We can tell whether the conveyor belts are moving or not, or whether they've jammed. So there are many things you can do to make the operation of the factory more efficient. But more than that, the factory can connect to information being provided by distribution centers. So this is a logistics provider who's holding goods in a warehouse for ultimate delivery to various customers. The question is, do they have sufficient capacity? And what rate do they plan to charge you for holding your stuff? And in real time, we can determine, hey, there's not either not enough capacity there, or because there's not enough capacity, their rates have gone up, and we're going to ship our goods off to a different center. Also, by connecting to the supply chain, we can figure out what demand is for our product and decide whether we want to accelerate the rate at which we're making things, or whether we want to slow things down because we're going to have to put goods in inventory. This now all becomes possible when you have the Internet of Everything. And putting it all together, here's this really complicated slide from a company called Libellium, which you can understand has business interest in making all of this happen. So that's where I got the slide. This is the smart world, or in this case, the smart city. So we have buildings. We have a park. And parks can dry out, like in California, and they can catch fire. And there's a river, and there's a bridge, and there's a convenient nuclear power plant in the city. There are pedestrians. There are vehicles. And you can understand that there are many, many, many systems that are required in order to make cities function efficiently. Not only do you have to have water, but you have to monitor its quality. Sometimes pollutants get into rivers before anybody knows about it. And it's not until people start getting sick that you realize that there has been a spill or a leakage, let's say, for example, from a nuclear power plant. Okay? Fires. How do people detect fires now? It's insane. They have people in tall towers, and they stand there with binoculars, and they watch until they see a flame. Then they push a button or something, and they warn people that, oh, there's a forest fire, we need to do something about it. Well, fires start a long time before you can see the flames from far away, because they're hidden by the trees. They're down on the ground. If, on the other hand, we deploy infrared detectors throughout places where there's a likelihood of fire, we would need people with binoculars. We'd know not only that there was a fire, we would know exactly precisely where it is and where it started. So if you look at all the kinds of systems that are required to make a city run, you can imagine everything operating much more efficiently than if these things were not instrumented. A good example, the lower tech example, is the MTR. When you install a system with Octopus, in which the Octopus card knows where you got on, what station you got on, and when, and which station you got off and when, even though the MTR doesn't know it's you, if you have an anonymous card like I have, they don't know it's me, but they know it's the same person. They have an immense amount of traffic data about exactly what the usage of the MTR is, so they know how frequently to run trains, they know what new stations are going to be needed, what new lines are appropriate, etc. When you don't have that information, the only way to get it is very expensive, if you care. And if you're not operating much of a profit, you basically forget about it, because you can't justify the expense of obtaining that information, like New York City, for example. That's a vision of where the Internet of Everything is going. This is just a blown-up view. In case you, when you walk around town, you don't think about all the infrastructure that's built there. There are water pipelines, underground power lines, communication lines, sewers, gas lines, highways, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of which in some way can benefit from talking to each other. And if you had to have a human mediate that, we don't have enough people on Earth to do that. And so the idea is that things are going to be talking directly to things. And only notifying humans when necessary to correct some kind of anomalous situation. Okay, one of the main techniques, go through a few technologies that are used in the Internet of Everything. One of them is RFID, a really brilliant invention conceived originally by the famous actress Hedy Lamarr in World War II, reputedly the most beautiful woman in the world for just a short time. She filed a patent application in the United States for this technology and was refused because it was classified a military secret. It was only after World War II that she and her co-inventor actually were granted the patent on radio frequency identification. So the idea of RFID, and your Octopus card is an RFID device, is that there is something called a tag that's part of the terminology of RFID, which usually consists of a small computer chip and a much larger antenna. And one of the beauties of RFID technology, and the reason I say it's brilliant, is you must be aware that this thin Octopus card does not have a battery. There's no source of power on it. And you know from your elementary physics that you cannot run a processor without electric power. So if there's a processor on there and there's no electric power, what is this Octopus card doing now? Is it asleep? Is it dead? Is it dreaming? Or is it very active? What's it doing? Okay? It's not doing anything because it doesn't have enough power to operate. It's sitting around waiting for somebody to energize it with some kind of power. Now, where does that come from? Well, in the MTR, it comes when you bring near a turnstile in the MTR. What's in that turnstile is a bigger antenna connected to a board that's connected to a computer that's connected to AC power, so it has plenty of power. And what it does is it's very friendly, and it sends out some power to the tag. And that power is enough to power up the tag for a very short amount of time. There's a small capacitor on here. It stores up some energy. And as the energy leaves the capacitor, it powers up the circuit. It does its thing. And in the case of Octopus, it does a lot. It does triple DES encryption. It does rewrites its registers. It records the last transaction, et cetera. It does a lot of stuff in a very short time. The amount of time actually is 100 milliseconds for what goes on an Octopus card. So what happens is that this antenna, I know I can make this work. The animation, it's going to work. It's really going to work. It wasn't working on my screen. There we go. So what this does is it sort of operates like a sonar on a submarine. Of course, sonar is acoustic, and acoustic waves are fairly slow. Pretty fast in water, but nothing like the speed of light. And what do submarines do? They make things. They go, ping. Okay, and then they listen to see if anything comes back. And if nothing comes back, they ping. And they just keep doing it all the time until an echo comes back. But the key is that once you ping, you have to shut up for a little while, otherwise you won't hear the echo because of your own sound. And that's exactly what I was capturing there, is it sends out individual pulses of energy. And most of the time, nothing comes back. But when there is an octopus card nearby, the octopus card will send the signal back. Okay? Now, there are many, many uses of RFID in the Internet of Things. This is a triple threat tag. It has human readable stuff on it. It has a barcode on it, which you could read with a laser. And on the back, you can see this antenna and this little chip there. If you take these tags and you put them on cartons, and you drive the cartons through or past this big antenna, you may have seen things like this in retail stores. They're used to detect stolen goods, okay, shoplifting. Because when you buy something, they say, well, they move it back and forth on the counter. What's that doing? It's passing it by an RFID reader that's deactivating the RFID device that's on whatever it was you were buying. Now, if there's a database somewhere that knows what the contents of this carton are, then as you drive into the warehouse, we can immediately, instantaneously update the inventory records. We know exactly what we have with no human intervention at all, other than, of course, you have to drive the stuff in. But, you know, I don't know how to get out of that. Right? But the driver himself doesn't have to do any records. And when the stuff leaves the warehouse, same thing happens. The inventory is decreased. This is a image from the U.S. Postal Service, which doesn't do much very right, but it loses a huge amount of money per year, in the range of $4 billion. But one of the things it does well is express mail, which is overnight mail. And one of the ways it tracks that stuff is every express mail envelope has a little RFID chip in it. And when these things arrive at a post office, they're put through a conveyor belt. It needs all of the RFIDs on those envelopes and updates a master database so you can track where your package is. You don't have to depend on people to scan it properly with a laser scanner. It happens automatically. The amazing thing is you can see there are lots of these envelopes there at the same time. And as they pass through this antenna, the antenna would be getting signals from lots of them. So how does it know which one to talk to? And there's some technology called an anti-collision protocol that is used for that, so that the reader can actually have an individual conversation with each individual RFID without getting confused. This is a retail application. Easy to take inventory if everything in the store has an RFID device in it. To take inventory, you just walk down the shelves with this handheld reader, and it reads all the RFIDs, and by the time you get to the door, you've inventoried the whole store. You don't have to close for a day like they used to in some stores. This thing. You'll recognize this as an ordinary surgical clamp used for stopping bleeding during surgery. The little nodule here is an RFID. It shouldn't take you long to figure out a good use for RFID on surgical instruments. I think the obvious one is that before the surgeon closes up, you'd like a nurse to come by with a reader and make sure that there are no instruments left inside the patient. Yes, that's the, sort of the obvious use. But there are more. Instruments need to be sterilized before use. And so when you bring an instrument into the operating room, you mark it in a database as non-sterile. Because even if it's not used during surgery, it can't be taken out and used again in the next surgery without being autoclaved. And so you make a record that it's non-sterile. Then you can make sure that every instrument before it is used in a surgery has been sterilized, because each one of these is going to have a unique serial number. Another thing is that surgeons like surgical kits. So for particular operations, they need a set of a particular collection of instruments in particular numbers. When you make up these sets, somebody might, it's done by hand, somebody might make a mistake. So you can just pass a wand reader over the thing and say, you know, cholecystectomy, yes, has all the instruments necessary for that. Okay? Many, many possible uses. This is an RFID diagnostic skin patch. No battery. It has a sensor, and it has that RFID communication chip in it. And you can measure various things. The skin temperature, you can actually measure glucose levels now, non-intrusively. You don't have to make people bleed to do it. And so this thing is sitting here doing nothing, because it has no power. But when a nurse comes by with a reader, the reader powers up the sensor and the chip, and a reading is taken and is transmitted back to the reader. So there's lots of stuff that's possible there. Retail applications, I think, are pretty obvious. If you put an RFID in clothing when you manufacture it, then, of course, you can do inventory. But you can also tell when you're doing inventory that something's out of place. As I go down this shelf, the shelf, of course, has an RFID also. So you know the shelf and the garment. And a database will tell you if that garment should be on that shelf or not, et cetera. Workers scan the stacks of jeans to discover which sizes have sold out and need to be replenished. Yes. Customers who purchase the jeans take the sensors home, but when they leave the store, they throw them in the trash along with other packaging. Well, I don't like that, actually. I don't think you should be discarding the RFID. I think the RFID should be permanently in the clothing. And the reason for that is that when it is discarded, we can read the RFID and we can know which garments have left the world, which means we know something about the lifetime of the garment. We know when it was sold. We know when it was thrown away. That's information that right now the manufacturers do not have, and they would love to know that. Because when you throw those jeans away, they want to make sure they sell you another one. You may not want them to do that, but they want to do that. Okay? So I don't agree with putting these things on the packaging. Okay. The world of RFID changed when Hitachi invented the Mu chip. Now we're moving into an area which looks like science fiction. It's right to me that way. The Hitachi Mu chip is an RFID device that is 0.4 millimeters square. I know you use the metric system here, but you might not have a concept on what 0.4 millimeters looks like. So I invite you to examine the index finger of your the joint of your index finger, first one. If your eyesight is better than mine, then you'll be able to see individual ridges in your fingerprint. 0.4 millimeters is about the distance between consecutive ridges in your fingerprint. So if you had one of these things or two of them on you, you would be inclined to wash your hands because you think you had some dirt on your hands. That's how tiny they are. The amazing thing to me about the Hitachi Mu chip is that the antenna is built into the chip. It doesn't do any good to have a microscopic chip if you have to have a big antenna, because that limits the kinds of things you can put the chip on. But it has the chip and the antenna. It can be read from a range of 1 foot and has 128 bits of storage, which doesn't seem like a lot. You certainly couldn't store your whole medical record on there. But 128 bits is is enough to individually address every atom on the face of the Earth. And since RFID chips and all objects occupy more than one atom, we're never going to run out of Hitachi RFID. They're small enough to put in currency, and they are in currency. They're in 100 euro notes. They're used for anti-counterfeiting, because unless you happen to have spent $6 billion, making a copy of the Hitachi fabrication plant for RFIDs, then the only source of 100 euro RFIDs is another 100 euro note. And it's a bad business model for a counterfeiter to destroy a 100 euro note in order to make a fake one. So they're effectively precluded from counterfeiting. What the European Central Bank is not telling you, but they're very happy about, is now they have the ability to track the flow of money. Every banknote in the world has a serial number. Nobody ever writes that number down unless there's been a kidnapping and it's used for ransom. When you spend a bill, the merchant doesn't copy down the serial number. But if his cash register were instrumented with an RFID reader, and every banknote that came in and every banknote that came out was recorded, and that information sent to the central bank, now all of a sudden they would know exactly where the cash was flowing, and criminals would get very scared about this because they use cash so they can't be traced. Now once they can be traced, they have a choice. Maybe they'll go straight, maybe they'll stop their horrible life of crime. Or if they don't, we're going to catch them and we're going to put them in jail. So there's a benefit. All right, I like the Hitachi new chip. Get ready for this, please. After the new chip, Hitachi invented RFID powder. This is 1/64th the size of the new chip. It's actually 1/8 by 1/8 in each dimension. Okay, so if it's 1/8 in each dimension, the whole area is 1/64th. Now, this is shows you some RFID powder in comparison to a human hair. I was not able to determine whether this is an Asian hair or a European hair, but Asian hairs are twice as thick. Factor of 2. But you can see they're still small, but in comparison to hair. Now, you must think that if it's so tiny, it can't possibly have the same characteristics as a new chip. You've got to have given up something when you made it that small. Strangely enough, it has exactly the same characteristics. It's readable from a foot and can store 128 bits. Now, this stuff is small enough, you can put it in anything. There's no object that you can physically handle that's so small that you can't put a piece of RFID powder on it. Okay? It's also very cheap, and it's very cheap in large quantity. In fact, the big difficulty with RFID powder is physically manipulating individual little pieces of it to get it on things. All right? Now, we'll talk about some possible applications of that. So this 128-bit limit, let's see if that's really constraining us. There is a new standard called the Electronic Product Code. You're very familiar with barcodes. You see them all the time. There are probably loads of barcodes floating around the room. A barcode has some substructure to it. The first digits are a code for the company, and those are assigned by a worldwide authority so that no companies have the same company code. Once you get your company code, you're free to use the actual individual serial number for whatever you want. The problem is there aren't that many digits to it. And so two bottles of water have the same barcode. The reason that that's okay is that the grocery store only cares what it is, so they know how to price it, know how to charge it for it. On the other hand, it would be useful to distinguish them because this one may have been adulterated during manufacture and is subject to a recall. But that one is pure. And we don't want to tell everybody, bring all your water in, because how can they tell the difference? They can't. They'd have to test it all. Whereas if every water bottle were unique, they had different serial numbers, then you could do recalls, you could do all kinds of, you could trace the life cycle of one bottle. Well, that's what the electronic product code is. You take the ordinary barcode, which only gets you down to the product level, like a 12-ounce bottle of Coke Light. Okay? If you add to it a unique serial number, that's what the electronic product code is. And this thing is 96 bits long. No, 96 less than 128. So you could use a piece of RFID powder to represent the electronic product code. Okay? This has a capacity for 200 billion serial numbers per item. So when Coca-Cola makes its 200 millionth and first can of Coke, it's going to have to change the product code there if it wants to assure complete uniqueness. Okay? Are we likely to run out of these? No. Okay? If you know what Avogadro's number is, and you take 2 to the 128 and divide by Avogadro's number, there's no problem at all. We're never going to run out of electronic product cards. Okay. Now, cheap and ultra-slim circuits could make the Internet of Things a reality. This was last Sunday. So this guy here is this Mr. White. Scott White, who is the CEO of a company that makes these things. And it looks like he's looking at a piece of plastic. But what he's actually looking at is some deposited RFID material. There are 2,000 integrated circuits on that piece of plastic. And so flat pieces of plastic are pretty easy to manipulate. And they're very cheap, and they can be attached to things with glue. And what he's saying, basically, is that he is able to make RFID devices a couple of orders of magnitude cheaper than you can with silicon. Which means that now price will be no object in terms of attaching RFIDs to things. Something which is slimmer than a human hair and very flexible, you can embed that in objects in a way that is not apparent to the user until it is called upon to do something. Okay? Now, we talked about power. Problem with RFIDs is they don't do anything until they're near a source of power, which means if they have a sensor on them, the sensor is inert until you bring a source of power nearby. Which means that if you would like to use the sensor to record the history of something, for example, the history of exposure of this package to temperature, you can't do that because it has no power. And so this technology, which is being developed at the University of Washington in Seattle, States, basically recognizes that there's power all over the place. How many of you have cell phones in the room? Raise your hand. I'd like to know. Well, the answer is everybody. Okay. So there are at least 80 cell phones on now. Anybody know the radiated power of a cell phone? Hmm? 1 milliwatt, yes. Okay, 1 milliwatt. So now we have 80 milliwatts of power in the room. 80 milliwatts is plenty for a very small RFID device to be continuously powered. You don't need a battery. You don't need a reader. It's like Spanish moss, right? Spanish moss is the stuff that grows on trees, and it acquires all of its nutrient from the air. It doesn't have roots in the ground. Okay? It just depends on stuff to come by that it absorbs. Well, that's exactly what this is, the Spanish moss of the Internet of Things. It's just absorbing energy at all times. And you know there's going to be more and more energy because the more and more wireless devices we have, they're continuously going to be emitting RF energy. So this is a technology that's now being developed so that we can have continuously on RFID devices. The smartphone's a terrific IT platform also. Good smartphones these days have at least 14 sensors in them. You know, the touchscreen's a sensor, right? It's sensing where you touch it. You might not have known that cell phones come with barometers. They have magnetometers. You know they have gyroscopes, so you can play games on the cell phone by moving it around, and it can tell what orientation it's in. They have GPS, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, GSM or 3G. Near-field communications, you know that you can use your cell phone as an octopus card. And they have cameras on the front and cameras on the back. And so I was just talking to a student, a graduate of HKU a week ago, who basically would like to be able to use cell phones for micro weather reporting. The idea is that your cell phone is detecting temperature and humidity and barometric pressure, and wherever you are, and we know to within 20 feet where you are, your GPS, and constantly uploading that information, not every second, but let's say once a minute. It uploads the temperature, pressure, et cetera, where you are. We aggregate all that information. It gives us a tremendous amount of information, at least at ground level and the level of apartment buildings and office buildings. Won't do much for the upper atmosphere. But at ground level, we can learn. It's a great little model. He even showed me he had a little anemometer that plugs into the cell phone. You hold it up like this, and it measures wind speed. And it tells you what the wind speed is, and it uploads the wind speed to some server that his environmental group is working on. Okay. Now, some more cartoons. There are implantable RFID tags that actually can be inserted into a human being. And so this guy is saying, we want to implant this for RFID tag. And he goes, that violates my rights. And over here he says, we want to implant this RFID tag in you, but it's also a cell phone, a digital camera, and an MP3 player. He likes that. But that's what you've got. If you have a cell phone with you all the time, that's not any different from having the thing implanted in you, except that you can put the cell phone back. But most people never do. Okay? In fact, they're willing to risk their lives crossing the street, watching the cell phone, and not even looking at the traffic. Now, the next cartoon is politically incorrect, but it's politically incorrect for two opposing groups, and I think it's fair. Okay? So what this one says is, under Chinese totalitarian system, the government watches our every move. And the rejoinder is, in a free country, that's done by the private sector. And it shows the Apple iPhone. So no matter what political system you're living under, you're being monitored all the time, either by the government or by companies. So let's go quickly through some other little mini internets. The internet of food. There are smart appliances and smart pantries. Here's a smart crock pot. Now, the question is, why would anybody ever buy a smart crock pot when for centuries they've lived with dumb ones and they've managed to cook? Why would you buy a smart one? Well, the smart crock pot by itself, if that were the only smart device on Earth, we probably wouldn't buy it. On the other hand, it has the ability to communicate with other things. Here, what you can do is get instructions on whatever it is that you want to cook. It tells you exactly how to set the crock pot, and you don't have to set it. What you do is you choose what you're cooking, and from your cell phone, it automatically sets the crock pot. Now, how do you decide what you want to cook? Well, you need to interrogate your pantry to make sure that you have enough raw materials in order to make that. How does your pantry know what's in it? Well, if everything had an RFID, then when it went in the pantry knows, and when you took it out, the pantry knows that too. There are the Pantelligent frying pan, too. The quirky egg minder. I don't know if this is a problem for you, but when you put eggs in a little egg tray, how do you know which is the oldest one? Maybe you have, because you want to use the oldest one first, unless it's gone bad, and you don't want to use it ever. I assume that lots of people have a protocol for how they actually put the eggs in, so to make sure that they take them out in the correct order. No more. You don't have to worry about that. If you get the quirky egg minder, then you pass this over the eggs, and it tells you which one is the oldest one. It tells you which one you can use. Okay. Now, when I first heard about the smart refrigerator, I said, who needs that? What could you do with it? Well, smart refrigerators are now so popular that the industry got together and they developed a data standard, a data model for refrigerators. And what it consists of a bunch of fields, and the fields have, you know, defined parameters. And the purpose of this is to be able to exchange data between kitchen devices, but also with the manufacturer. So you understand that refrigerators have different food compartments. The freezer, the grocery, and the vegetables are kept at different temperatures. Right? There's the door. You want to know if the door has been opened or not. You want to know if there's enough ice in the ice tray. And you want to measure the usage of power. You can detect, for example, if the Freon is starting to leak because the temperature is starting to rise in the refrigerator. All of this information is monitored by various devices in the fridge and is converted to this standard data model so the fridge can communicate with all kinds of other devices. We're going to see all kinds of standards like this in different industries. The Internet of Sports. Adidas is really big on this. Okay, so you know about watches and Fitbits that are measuring your physical activity. That's easy. The smart ball. This is actually a ball made by Adidas that has wireless devices in it that record the speed and the rotational velocity of the ball. And they send that information to a cell phone. So you can see, if you're a soccer coach, you can measure how fast people are able to kick the ball. And you're able to determine whether they can spin the ball. For corner kicks, right, you have to be able to cause the ball to curve. And so what this is going to do is enable, you know, what's the world's most popular game? It's football, right? And you guys call football. Deference to my audience. It's not football at all. It's soccer. This is the speed cell. It is you can see it's a USB device that you put in your shoe, and it records the speed, distance, and the rate of stride, that is, how far it is between individual hittings of the shoe on the ground. Okay? The Internet of Health, you might strike you as a little more important. The Proteus pill consumption tracking device. This requires an RFID in each pill. No problem if it's RFID powder. By the way, RFID powder is made of silicone. It's not completely non-toxic. When you eat food in a restaurant, you get more toxins than you would from an RFID pill. So you don't have to worry about it. This is a glucometer measuring glucose level. This is amazing. This is one of those thin film sensors which you apply to the skin, and it's able to do continuous blood chemistry. And so you can determine at various times of the day your glucose levels low, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And on and on and on. This is the iRhythm cardiac sensor. You put it here, and it transmits your EKG to a cell phone. You can actually watch your EKG if you want to. And in real time, it transmits it to your doctor. So you can watch it along with you. Intelligent pharmaceuticals follow on. Once you have an ingestible pill that has a chip, this is just symbolic. You don't actually put it on the top of the pill. It's embedded inside the pill. They photographed one with a chip inside. You wouldn't be able to tell there was a chip. So, the ingestible pill, then you put an RFID receiver on the tummy, and you can see if there's an intestinal blockage, exactly where the intestinal blockage is, et cetera. Now, we'll end with vehicles as computing platforms. I already said how great they are for IT purposes. Notice this. This is heavy traffic, which could be anywhere, Hong Kong, the United States, California, et cetera. What we've got here is a swarm of cars that, in essence, form what's referred to as an ad hoc network. An ad hoc network is one in which connectivity is determined by instantaneous conditions, as opposed to the HKU network, which the wired network is not ad hoc. The wireless network is ad hoc, because when you come into the room, you're being serviced by the wireless access point in this particular room. But the question is, what is the network that these cars are forming? And here's the answer. This is an article that appeared last year, still good. NHTSA stands for the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. It's the part of the U.S. Department of Transportation that's worried about highway safety. They propose mandating B2B communications. Not only did they propose it, but the proposal passed. Now, all cars manufactured in the United States after 2016 are required to enable vehicle-to-vehicle communications, B2B communications. Why? They require all new passenger cars and light trucks be capable of talking to each other. Not the people in them talking to each other. The vehicles are talking to each other to help avoid and mitigate crashes. And here's an example of what that looks like. So we have a bunch of, okay, they're high-end cars, but we have a bunch of cars on the road. This car is emitting this information. It's telling what kind of car it is, how much it weighs, how fast it's going, what its acceleration is, the measured coefficient of friction between the tires and the road, and whether the driver's paying attention or not. How does it know that? Well, the Mercedes these days, they actually have sensors that watch to see if you're moving around like this within the marked lanes on the highway. They assume that if you're doing that you're really not paying attention. So they broadcast this information to whom? Well, to the other cars in the neighborhood that are capable of hearing it. And so if all the cars are doing this, then what's able to be done is for sensors and servers in the cars to be able to take evasive action. If somebody is driving dangerously, then the rest of the guys accelerate away from them, except the guy behind him has to slow down. Yeah, I don't want to accelerate right into that. And so this is an interesting idea, but when it gets to the point where the government requires it, then you know that it's really serious. Okay, and so the Internet of Everything. Cisco, which has a tremendous interest in this. Why? Because if something's on the internet, it's communicating through routers, and Cisco sells routers. So they love the idea. More devices on the internet, the more money Cisco makes. They have estimated that 99.4% of things that should be connected aren't yet. That probably excites all the executives at Cisco because it means they have a long way to go. And they're predicting that there will be 200 to 800 billion devices connected to the internet in the next 10 years. There will not be 200 to 800 billion people. In the next 10 years, we might get up to 8 billion people or something like that. So what that means is, at the high end, we're predicting that there'll be 100 connected devices for every person on Earth. That's way more than your capability used to be in the Internet of People when you were sitting at one device at a time and keying things in and clicking on hyperlinks. And so in their vision, it's the tip of the iceberg. They actually predict that 2 billion connected devices will be shipped in 2014. I think most of those are cell phones. On the other hand, it's going to grow to 8 billion devices for the year 2020. That's not going to be mostly cell phones. Not possible. Okay, it's going to be other stuff. And these colors are indicating which markets are anticipated to be the big ones in the year 2020. So that's Cisco's vision of the Internet of Everything and my vision of the Internet of Everything. I think that's where it's going, and I'm looking forward to that world. I just got a new cell phone, and the first time I texted my wife to tell her that I was taking the lift to the MTR, I had to literally type the letters MTR, because a Samsung Galaxy Note 4 doesn't know the MTR. Okay? The next day, when I texted her, it knew. Okay? And so the whole idea of smart, connected devices making everybody's life. Questions?